Inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to The Core here on American Family Radio. Glad to have you with us on the program on American Family Radio. If you want to subscribe to the podcast, you can go over to your podcast library, your podcast store, and for free, you can download The Core podcast. Just type in the name of the program, click the subscribe button, and the podcast will be queued up in your library each and every day that we upload the program. So this is a Share-a-thon week. Beginning tomorrow is Share-a-thon full steam ahead. We do this twice a year in the fall and now in the spring, and we're looking forward to having you join us for our twice annual Share-a-thon fundraiser for American Family Radio. So we'll see you tomorrow here on the show for most of the day to broadcast the Share-a-thon and ask you to come alongside us, not only with your prayers, but also with your financial support to support the ministry. You can find out more information about that over at afr.net, afr.net. We're in Proverbs chapter 5 this week, Proverbs chapter 5. Looking at verse 21, "For the ways of a man are before the eyes of the Lord, and he watches all his paths." For the ways of a man are before the eyes of the Lord, and he watches all his paths. So if you thought that you were skirting the visibility of the Lord, the oversight of God, you're wrong. You're wrong. And, you know, we've always been told that the Lord sees it all. And that saying is true. Proverbs chapter 5, verse 21, "For the ways of a man are before the eyes of the Lord, and he watches all his paths." It's often easy to think that, well, the Lord doesn't have, out of all this earth, the Lord doesn't have the time or the capacity to know each man and each man's ways. But that's counter scripture. That's not what the scripture says. The scripture says, "For the ways of a man are before the eyes of the Lord, and he watches all his paths." So let that be an encouragement for you. If you're living righteously, let that be an encouragement for you, that your good deeds are not going unnoticed. If you're living unrighteously, let that be a warning shot across the bow that the Lord is watching. The Lord is aware, and he will remember it when it comes judgment day, those who defy his ways and defy his word. There is judgment day. And judgment isn't something that everybody loves talking about, but the reality of scripture is that there is heaven and hell. And the believer and the unbeliever alike will face judgment, final judgment. And you are going to want to be found good and faithful, a good and faithful servant before the Lord. So remember that. And let the fear of the Lord be healthy. Let it be a healthy fear that drives you towards the things of the Lord. That's what the fear of the Lord is intended to do, and that is to draw us to himself. That's Proverbs chapter 5, verse 21. Well, we've got a guest in the second and the third, but I'm going to go ahead and jump into some stories for the segment, this segment. The first thing I want to do is play this clip from the Commerce Secretary, Howard Lutnick. And in this clip, he's talking about something I actually alluded to last week, and that is the national security implications to exporting manufacturing, and sending manufacturing overseas. What are the national security implications for that? There's a lot. There's a lot of national security implications for shipping our jobs and our manufacturing capacity overseas. Let's listen to this clip. This is Howard Lutnick talking about how we've shipped much of our national security industry overseas.
You've got to realize this is a national security issue. I mean, we don't make medicine in this country anymore. We don't make ships. We don't have enough steel and aluminum to fight a battle, right? All our semiconductors are made overseas, so every button we press when we try to start our car or even use our microwave, these are all semiconductors. They're all made elsewhere. We've got to start to protect ourselves, and we've got to stop having all the countries of the world ripping us off. We have a $1.2 trillion trade deficit, and the rest of the world has a surplus with us. They're earning our money. They're taking our money.
Right.
And Donald Trump has seen this, and he's going to stop it. So it is going to be a big change. Of course it's going to be a big change, but the rest of the world has been ripping us off for all these many years. Donald Trump has seen it. He's spoken about it.
I understand
that. And he's just not going to take it anymore, and that's his model.
Well, that's Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick talking about how we have exported the manufacturing capacity for much of our pharmaceutical industry, even a lot of our steel and aluminum, and the chips. The computer chips have been largely produced overseas. We just don't have the capacity today to backfill that. If the supply chain were to break down, we saw this during COVID, if the supply chain were to break down, we don't currently have the capacity to make up for that loss, which is a really bad place to be. And we point out all of these issues, and then when we talk about fixing it, everybody throws up their hands. They don't want to try to fix it. And President Trump, through this tariff announcement last week, he's already got 50 countries to the table, 50 nations at the negotiating table. Now tell me who else and how else you can get 50 countries and their trade representatives to the negotiating table in 48 hours. How can you do that without the use of what I call the tariff tool? The reality is there is no other way, at least that anybody's ever found, to get 50 trade partners to the negotiating table in under 48 hours. And that's what President Trump did. And I think this is all going to level out. I think the market's going to level out. I honestly think we're probably at the bottom. That's just my guess, and I'm not an economist, so take it for what it's worth. But I think we're probably at the market bottom for this correction, for this drop. And it's not these stock market declines over the past few days have been historic. The numbers are in some ways unprecedented, especially consecutive day drops. So I'm not downplaying the market drops, but what I am trying to do is bring sensible discussion to the table. And right now, there's just so much hysteria. And what I find, and Bobby and I were talking about this morning, Bobby, what I find quite ironic is many of the so-called economists and talking heads on TV that are talking like this stock market drop is apocalyptic and the end of the world. These folks, many of them are buying the bottom. They're buying into the market because they know it's a trusted system.
All the while demeaning his acts, policies, procedures, ideologies, et cetera.
But buying into it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Why not? This is the Warren Buffett effect.
Yes.
When everybody else is fleeing, that's when he scoops in and swoops in and buys, scoops up the opportunity. So.
Yes. And not to mention, there was a lot of talk about how the tech sector was overvalued, way overweighted. A lot of talk about that.
Yeah, and for some time.
Yeah, even going in before the inauguration. So this talk goes back months. And so I just think that there's so much focus, and I think it has to do with the Never Trump syndrome. I do. I really do. There's half of the country, Bobby, that wants Trump to fail. Let's remember that. Let's not forget. Maybe not half, 45%. There's 45% of the country that is cheering for Trump to fail here.
And that even though his approval ratings are
over
on
50%.
Fire.
Yeah. He has
even after the tariffs and through the tariff talk.
Yeah. So he's holding in there. The support for his presidency is holding in there. But my point is that President Trump wakes up with 45% of people wanting him to fail. And with that And then you throw in tariffs, and then there's split in the conservative movement on whether tariffs are good or not. And it just causes this kind of uproar that the media, of course, is latching onto. And don't get me wrong, these are revolutionary actions that he's doing. I mean, this is some pretty generational type change that we haven't seen in a long, long time. Some of it we've never seen as far as the level of change that he's bringing about. So I'm not downplaying that. It's not surprising. There is a lot of change going on in Washington. But the memo that I'm just trying to bring to the table is that, folks, this country was not hunky-dory before Trump got in there. All right? So let's don't act like everything was just dandy and then Trump's coming in and he's messing everything up. No. This country was, and arguably still is in many ways, is going towards this cliff, and nobody has any way to stop us. And Trump's got some ideas on how to slow this train ride off the cliff down, but nobody wants to hear it or do it in Washington.
Yeah,
they just want status quo.
And to that point of the status quo, how many times, no matter what side of the aisles you come down on, Democrat, Republican, Libertarian, et cetera, Green Party, the government is bloated.
Yes.
It's hugely indebted. Everybody acknowledges that point.
It's been propping up the economy.
Yeah. Well, artificially, but eventually that bubble has to burst.
Right.
But now somebody's trying to do it methodically, mm-hmm. and is taking large cuts and big swaths because that's what it takes to get us down to some kind of a balanced budget and some kind of normalcy.
Yeah.
And it's going to hurt. And again, most of our audience has heard short-term pain for long-term gain. And we can't emphasize it enough. 6 to 9 months, folks, you're going to see some difference in this country.
Well, and think about how far we've gotten off. I mean, how bad it is. You look at the gutting of the American manufacturing base.
Yes.
We've been in a manufacturing payroll recession for 2 years, folks. Meaning every month after month, we are bleeding manufacturing jobs under Biden for the last 2 years. And so when you look at where we've been, we've been in a really bad spot, all right? And the national security concerns here, folks, we saw this during COVID, and this is why, to your point, Bobby, I do think there is a lot of favorability. There is a lot of approval for what President Trump's doing at the grassroots ground level, because people that we talk, like the way we talk on this program, is how people feel out there. They've seen the empty factories. They've seen the manufacturing gutted. And then during COVID, we saw the pharmaceutical supply chain get all in a tizzy coming from China. All that got disrupted. And we were all sitting around going, wow, why are we getting our insulin from China? That doesn't even make sense. Why are we getting our chips from Taiwan? So we can't complete a vehicle, an automobile build, until we get the chips from Taiwan, or we can't build some military equipment, or we can't do the XYZ or build these computers or these AI facilities without these chips. And we're all looking at that, and your average person looks at that and goes, man, that's not good. That's not normal. Why would a country like America rely on foreign adversaries for the production of life-saving supplies? And then the solution is, okay, well, let's fix that. Let's reshore that industry, which I talked about this even in the days following COVID. I talked about this, about how we need to bring our pharmaceutical manufacturing production back to America. And that's what President Trump is trying to do. So I just think that I think in the long run, and when I say in the long run, I'm talking the next 12 to 24 months, maybe even sooner, I think President Trump's going to be exonerated here. Now, in the history books, everybody's going to negotiate and debate, were his tactics correct? Should he have levied this many tariffs in such a short period of time? Look, we can debate that, and good people can disagree on that. But I think the end result of all of this, what seems chaotic, the end result, I'm telling you, he's going to be exonerated. President Trump and his administration will reshore many manufacturing jobs. You will see a lot of investment in it. You will see good jobs numbers. You will see real wage gains. All of this will come back to exonerate President Trump. We'll be back.
Well, the song says, please come to Boston. And if you are a baby boomer in particular, you remember that popular song from the 1970s? Well, we're going to Boston. We here at American Family Association and American Family Radio are going to take a tour of that great historic city and the whole surrounding area. And that's going to be in October. And we're about three quarters of the way full with our tour there. And then, of course, we're going to Colonial Williamsburg, Jamestown, and Yorktown, as well as a tour of Washington, D.C., and George Washington's Mount Vernon. We're doing that in June and September. And so if you want information on any of our 2025 tours, go to wildmangroup.com, W-I-L-D-M-O-N, group.com, for all the information, and hopefully we'll see you in Boston.
At the Core podcast are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to The Core here on American Family Radio. And when I talk about how I think that if this isn't the bottom, or Friday wasn't the bottom of the stock market, the recent drop, you know, I think today or tomorrow, I would think would be, because when you're looking at it now, nothing substantially has changed. I mean, President Trump came out this morning sticking to his guns. So, and the market's roughly flat. It possibly could end the day in green. At least I'm looking at the Dow. And other NASDAQ's up 1 point. S&P's up now, a little less than 1 point. But, you know, President Trump hasn't come out and given anything to kind of pump the market, right? Any kind of backing down, if you will, from his tariff position. And the market's roughly flat. Some of the sectors are up a little bit. So I think this too shall pass. And as I mentioned, I think President Trump will end up getting exonerated. To use kind of a court term, I think he'll get exonerated on this. And I think it'll be good for the country. The end result will be good for the country. I do want to move on to our next guest. We have on with us Missouri Representative Melanie Stinnett. She's on with us now to talk about some of her work in the Missouri legislature. Representative, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me. Happy to be with you.
Well, we've had on several lawmakers and kind of policy makers to talk about some creative resolutions or innovations when it comes to healthcare in our country, and not to get confused with health insurance, because those are two different things, and we try to talk about both of them and what's best for the consumer, for the average citizen. But from a healthcare vantage point, you're working in the state legislature there in Missouri to make things more affordable and less red tape. So give us a little backgrounder to this topic of healthcare, specifically in Missouri.
Sure. And I'll give you kind of just a quick background about me so people kind of know where I'm coming from. I am a speech pathologist by trade and owned a private business in Springfield, Missouri, offering therapy services for children. And it was kind of my introduction into policy, if you will, because of the regulations and red tape that were present for me to be able to just do my job and do it well, provide quality care to children in our state. And so it was really from that vantage point that I made the decision to run for office and come into office. So it's been really a passion project of mine to take a look at healthcare, and as you said, healthcare and health insurance, two totally different things. I think we have to be looking at healthcare and making sure that we're making good decisions that cut that red tape and make sure that patients have access to the care that they need. And one of those bills that I filed this year, we call the Hope for Missouri Patients Act. And it deals with some of these individualized treatments for people who have, you know, significant medical diagnoses that are life-threatening things, a lot of terminal conditions that may not have FDA-approved treatments, but patients want to have some access to these individualized care options.
Let me ask you this, Representative. Once again, we're talking to Missouri State Representative Melanie Stinnett. The concern or the pushback on some of these experimental treatments or some of these kind of novel treatments that haven't been FDA approved yet. What's kind of the safety background here? Because, you know, the people think that being FDA approved is somehow magical in and of itself. But right. talk about kind of this unproven fear for new, younger, novel, in some ways, treatments for some of these illnesses.
Yeah, well, I think when we talk about the FDA and we talk about their approval, it really doesn't take into account considering the most up-to-date medical practices and technologies of today that are more individualized for patients, right? The FDA sort of looks at overarching, more one-size-fits-all sort of industrial model approvals for these treatments. But we're talking about things that are, you know, really rare diseases, things that are terminal, and people have tried all of these treatments that may or may not be available to them in their communities easily. And what they're looking for is an option to be able to do something that maybe new, maybe, as you said, novel, but the FDA isn't really structured to be able to swiftly approve things like that. But that does not mean that someone shouldn't have access to that type of care if it could be of benefit to them with those types of rare diseases that are challenging to figure out in a quick way and then get through that FDA process and spending, you know, the millions of dollars that it takes and sometimes decades to go through that process. You know, our constituents and our communities deserve to have options available to them if that's what they choose.
Let me ask you this. The off-label use is a very common thing. Anybody who talks about mm-hmm. using something off-label, that just means it's not being used primarily for what it was approved for, but it could still be proven safe and effective for some of these other tertiary needs. The mm-hmm. when you talk about the Hope for Missouri Patients Act, is this aimed at giving physicians kind of this freedom, this liberty from maybe a liability vantage point to go and venture down these off-label uses, or is it just flat out not allowed right currently to explore some of these more new experimental treatments? What is this aimed at changing as far as a law or regulation that is going to open the door for physicians to prescribe or use some of these newer or different treatments?
Yeah, it's my understanding these just are not allowed to be put in place or tried by patients. And so it is a frustrating component for someone, as I mentioned, who may be terminally ill and is just trying to get some, you know, potentially even just some relief. It may not be a cure. It may not be something that sets them free from the disease that they have, but makes them more comfortable or slows the challenges of that disease. And, you know, from a vantage point from a physician, you know, it is challenging. I also think that people often think that these bills are aimed towards making an insurance company pay for something. And that's not the case either. Many of these patients are willing to pay out of pocket or find a way to pay for these treatments, but they just simply aren't allowed to without this legislation. And so, you know, I think there are still some guardrails in the legislation that ensure safety. You know, we don't want people, you know, accessing treatment in a way that's unsafe. That's certainly not the goal. But I do believe that there are ways to go about this. I believe my legislation is a roadmap to be able to do that. Missouri would be one of, I believe, we would potentially be the seventh state to do so. So it's not that there haven't been other states to do it, but I do think it allows Missouri to be more innovative in the way that they approach medicine and allow physicians and their patients to make those decisions closer to where the patient is versus where the federal government is or where the insurance company is. I always believe that getting closer to the patient and that physician and patient making that decision is the best thing.
Absolutely. Once again, we've been talking to Missouri State Representative Melanie Stinnett on her bill in the Missouri legislature, the Hope for Missouri Patients Act, which is aimed at opening the door for life-saving or at least life-altering treatments for folks who are going through rare diseases or sometimes terminal illnesses. Let me shift gears to the issue of abortion and the issue of life in Missouri. Unfortunately, Missouri was one of those states that fell victim to this ballot amendment process. It's been hijacked by the left to force states, force these pro-abortion policies into these states. What can be done? This is unfortunately the pro-life movement kind of got caught flat-footed here when it comes to these ballot amendment processes. But can anything or what can be done at the state legislative level to offset or to counteract some of these pro-abortion policies?
Yeah, because of what we've seen with the initiative petition process in Missouri, what has to happen at this point is that either the legislature has to pass a House joint resolution or Senate joint resolution that would go to a vote of the people at the ballot again, or we would have to rely on our citizens to collect signatures and go through that initiative petition process again with something that is different than what we see that passed with Amendment 3. So it's a cumbersome process. I think that there are certainly pieces of Amendment 3 that many people want to see changed and addressed. And those are certainly conversations that, you know, I'm hearing throughout the building all the time.
Hmm. Yeah, something's got to be done because, you know, obviously this Amendment 3 doesn't truly reflect the majority of voters in Missouri. I almost guarantee you if you poll the voters of Missouri on the life issue, they're not going to come down as radical as Amendment 3. But what happens is these radical pro-abortion groups come into the state, pump millions of dollars, misinform a lot of people, and then folks show up at the ballot box and they either don't know what they're voting for or they're confused on what they're voting for. So I think something's got to be done, and it probably is going to have to start with the legislature in some way just to build some momentum. The last thing I want to mention is back to the issue of healthcare. What are some other things that you're working on, whether it be in healthcare or the health insurance? Because the healthcare costs are just exorbitant, and then you get into health insurance, and those costs have gone up too. So, what are some things that can be done at the state level to really make healthcare and health insurance better quality?
Yeah, one of the bills that I've been working on for the past few years has to do with reining in the requirements that insurance companies put in place for prior authorizations. And, you know, when I talk to groups of people, if I ask people to raise their hand, there's really no one who hasn't had an experience with prior authorization getting in the way to their access to healthcare. Many times those prior authorizations either take too long or they require things that are outside of the plan of care that the physician laid out and put in place for the patient. So for instance, you know, they want to get some specific type of imaging, but the insurance company says, oh no, you have to go do this many physical therapy appointments before we'll give you prior authorization for that. And those things are frustrating for patients, but beyond just being frustrating, they add cost to our healthcare because the physician's office and the insurance company have to have people working on and processing these prior authorizations. But even more importantly than that, they insert delays to care for patients. And so, again, when we were talking earlier about making sure that those decisions are made as close to the point of that relationship with the physician and the patient, I think what my prior authorization bill does is target that as well, making sure that if a physician and a patient agree that this is a course of treatment that they think is best for them, the insurance companies, we don't want them getting in the way of that access to care and delaying treatment, because we know that delayed treatment just inserts more costs in the long run as well if a patient doesn't get that care as quickly as possible. So that's a great bill that I've been working on for several years. I hope to see it get to the finish line this year. But we've got a good group. I chair the Health and Mental Health Committee in our House, and we've had a great group of bills that are really trying to focus again on that access to care, but good quality care and decreasing costs. doing that from a conservative mindset, though, really focusing on, you know, what it looks like to make sure that patients are making the decisions for their care.
Absolutely. Once again, we've had on with us Representative Melanie Stinnett out of Missouri, the state of Missouri there, talking about some of her legislation that she has worked on in the past and is working on now. Representative, thanks so much for coming on the program.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day.
Absolutely. You too. That's Representative Melanie Stinnett out of Missouri, and her legislation is called the Hope for Missouri Patients Act, and it's mainly centered at opening up some of these experimental or novel drugs and treatments to seriously ill patients and allowing physicians to be in the driver's seat and patients as well when it comes to some of these more rare diseases in Missouri. So thanks for her work and appreciate her coming on the program. The health insurance and health care are two major policy topics that I wouldn't be surprised if President Trump and Congress at some point try to weigh in on this, just because of how terrible Obamacare has been for the country and the healthcare and insurance industry. But healthcare and insurance are two distinctly different things, and that's what I try to differentiate when I talk about this subject. Whether I'm talking about healthcare or health insurance, I try to make the point to differentiate between the two, because the pro-Obamacare folks have been kind of hammering it into our mind that everything is about affordable care. That's why they named the bill Affordable Care Act, even though it made prices for health insurance skyrocket. But the Affordable Care Act was all about meddling in the insurance industry. It was all about meddling in the private insurance industry, and it had nothing to do with actual health care. And so both of these areas need some serious reforms. On the health insurance side of things, we've got way too much government intervention. Way too much government intervention. We need more competition. That's the problem, is you've got these massive insurance agencies that are dominating the market. Folks literally don't have anywhere else to go other than the, quote, public exchange, which is government-run healthcare, or health insurance, rather. And then on the health care side of things, you've got way too much overhead cost, way too much administrative cost. You've got not enough competition and transparency and options there. And the pricing structure is overly confusing on the healthcare side of things. Trying to ask a physician or a medical system what your pricing is, they look at you like you're an alien. What is our pricing? So there's a lot of reform that needs to take place both on health insurance and health care.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio with your host, Walker Wildman.
Welcome back to The Core here on American Family Radio. Walker Wildman here with you on this edition of the program. Glad to have you on the show with us. As I mentioned in the first segment, you can subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. Just type in the name of the program and then click the subscribe button, and the show will be queued up in your library each and every day. Well, before we jump to our next guest, I want to remind you of several events that we have coming up at American Family Association and other events. The Activate Summit is coming up in June, and registration is actually going to close out this month. In the middle of April. So if you do want to join us at the Activate Summit, the dates are June 12th through the 14th in Tupelo, Mississippi, Activate Summit 2025. We would love to have you join us. Our theme is Biblical Bedrock, Building on the Authority of Scripture. So you can go over to afa.net/events, check out that event, plus every other event that we have on the calendar for the year. So we enjoy getting out and fellowshipping and meeting some of our supporters, and these events are just one of many ways that we do that. Jumping to our next guest, we have on with us Ray Hederman. He's Executive Director of the Economic Research Center at the Buckeye Institute, and he's Vice President of Policy at the Buckeye Institute as well. Ray's with us now. Hey, Ray, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Walker. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, Ray, we just actually wrapped up last segment talking to a Missouri representative, Melanie Stinnett, about some of her bills in the Missouri legislature regarding health care and some reforms there that need to take place. But down in Mississippi, we're dealing with, have been dealing with, an attempt at Medicaid expansion. And we've had multiple guests on in recent months to kind of talk about this overarching topic. But before we jump down to the Magnolia State and talk about the concerns with Medicaid expansion, tell us, Ray, how we got here through the Obamacare route and other things. Tell us how we get to this point where there's so many concerns and problems with Medicaid at the state level.
Yeah, so Medicaid at its heart is a partnership between the federal governments and state governments. And the idea was the federal government provides a lot of the money and the state administers it. And the problem is, you know, Medicaid started out in the 1960s as part of the Great Society, you know, aimed at very needy people. How are we going to help disabled people, poor elderly people, poor women? And over time, we've seen an expansion where Medicaid covers more and more people. The most famous example, or infamous, if you will, was in 2009 when President Obama enacted Obamacare, which really changed the social contract of Medicaid. The idea was, you know, Medicaid was going to be a way to help people that needed government assistance. Again, this were aged, blind, disabled, poor elderly, poor children, poor women, to help them while they were pregnant. And Medicaid in 2009 said, look, we're going to give benefits to healthy working age adults. And this is a pretty radical reform, because even back, you know, in the Great Society with FDR, the idea was you had to work to receive benefits. And Medicaid expansion, funnily, many changed that program. And of course, that meant that states were going to have a huge hit to their bottom line. States are going to come up with a lot more money. So the federal government essentially bribed states and said, look, you know, normally the federal government pays about 2/3 of a Medicaid bill. But for these healthy adults, they're going to pay 90 cents on the dollar. And so you've seen kind of this weird alliance of people pushing Medicaid expansion throughout the nation between hospitals, some healthcare providers who get a lot more money, and a lot of big government liberals. And the consequence is, you know, a lot of people have gone on Medicaid and haven't gotten off. And Walker, that means that these people have become dependent on the federal government and have left the labor force, haven't come back. And that's one of the things that President Trump is trying to do, is bring back work as a bedrock American value where people try to work for their benefits.
Yeah. This is the concern. One of the concerns with expanding Medicaid at the state level is, number one, to act like this is all free and nobody's got to pay for it. It's just fundamentally not true. I mean, we're running a multi-trillion-dollar deficit at the federal level, and it's not like we've just got cash sitting around to fund the expansion of this program, Medicaid. And so that being kind of the point number one, is that Washington is in no fiscal position to just be expanding programs and saying, hey, we'll cover 90% of it, or whatever the percentage breakdown is. And then at the state level, we're not in a financial position either to expand this this program, because the state's going to have to pick up a portion of it. And I know that portion varies, but that's the fiscal side of it. But what you alluded to, it's kind of this moral and work ethic side of it, where we're incentivizing folks not to work. And that's very, very problematic when you don't have work requirements. And it just really, it negatively affects the state and the workforce in the long haul.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, to your first point about, you know, where the federal government is right now running massive federal deficits. You know, we saw the impact when, you know, the Biden administration spent well beyond our means. We saw, you know, inflation roaring back to the highest level in 40 years because we had an unsustainable fiscal deficit. And, you know, those of us have always said, like, look, you cannot spend beyond your means. Eventually, it's going to catch up to you. And we saw that, you know, with mortgage rates at 7%. 5% higher, you know, basically people looking at grocery prices rising 5% every year, at least higher for some goods. And so the federal government right now, Republicans are trying to figure out how they can bring down this budget deficit. And so what we've been seeing is the last, you know, several years, a lot of healthcare providers and hospitals have been saying, look, let's spend more on Medicaid. Because what happens is the more a state spends, the more federal dollars that a state can receive because of that partnership program. But now the federal government, right, can't keep subsidizing everybody else in the world. So the federal government's tightening your belt, which means that prudent states, and Mississippi is acting prudently in this regards, needs to be careful about expanding, spending more on Medicaid when the federal government is looking at a lot of loopholes and gimmicks states have used to draw down more federal tax dollars, because you don't want to create long-term spending obligations, right? You don't want to take on a big debt if you can't pay for it. And when the federal government is looking, you know, for money under seat cushions, trying to crack down on fraud, gimmicks, ways they're paying out to states, ways they're paying out to corporate tax breaks, it's not a good time to creating risky spending patterns. And that's part of the discussion that we've seen down south in Mississippi and play out, quite frankly, in a lot of states across the nation.
Yeah. The legislation you're talking about in Mississippi was Senate Bill 2867, and this was an attempt at Medicaid expansion, of which the governor, Governor Tate Reeves, thankfully vetoed because of some of the glaring problems that you've brought up here on the program. Talk a little bit about that, because that's a bold move. It's a good move by the governor, but a bold move when you have the legislature, clearly at least a majority of the legislature, behind this Medicaid expansion.
Yeah, you know, Governor Reeves basically said, look, you know, I'm going to protect the Mississippi taxpayers against some of these interests. And a lot of the Mississippi hospitals, you're in favor of it because they got more money. And, you know, Governor Reeves looked and said, I don't think this is in the best interest of the Mississippi taxpayer. And especially now that Mississippi, you know, is being bold and on track to eliminate their income tax. And so Governor Reeves is saying, look, this is not the time that we start taking a risk of drawing down more federal funding, shifting funding around to pay for something that could result in higher taxes. And so, you know, there were some provisions in the bill Governor Reeves could be open to and negotiate with the state legislature overall. But basically the message is, you know, we've heard from the Trump administration, they want to be careful on Medicaid spending overall. So now is not the right time to be, you know, moving and running money around, shelling out more money in an attempt to get more money from the federal government. You know, taxpayer protection is at the centerpiece of Governor Reeves' veto message. And I think he made a wise decision, you know, protecting them. And then he's open to negotiating lawmakers and some other aspects of the bill that won't put taxpayers on quite as much risk.
Yeah, that's right. Once again, we've been talking to Ray Hederman with the Buckeye Institute, where he serves as executive director of their Economic Research Center. He's also a vice president of policy there at the Buckeye Institute. And one addition to your comments, Ray, is that we kind of operate under this assumption, and I fall guilty of this sometimes, where we assume that a program is constitutional, that it's right, that it's virtuous, that it's good, and that it's within the purview of the government. And we kind of operate and begin debating the tenets of said legislation with that in mind. But with some of this, Ray, some of this, it's like, why aren't we even considering, is this even the government's role? I mean, is this even the government's role to expand benefits to cover able-bodied working age adults with these programs, or should the private sector jump in and pick this up on its own? But on that note, talk about some of the positive reforms that maybe some states have already done, but talk about some of the positive reforms that states can do to even shore up and improve their current Medicaid programs.
Yeah, so some states are basically going back to the tenets of work. Ohio, we recently submitted a work requirement waiver. The Trump administration is very open to that, saying, look, If you're an somebody between 18 and 55, you're healthy, you're not taking care of children, you should be in the workforce at least part-time or in school, you know, making yourself better. And we really need a mentality shift that goes back, you know, that says, if you're going to get a lot of these benefits from the federal government, you know, we're asking you to better yourself as well. You know, that could be through a work program, that could be through a job training program, it could be attending a community college class, because that really gets back at some of the work ethic, right? That basically when people drop out of the workforce, and our research shows that people can earn hundreds of thousands of dollars over their lifetime, because once you drop out of work to get your Medicaid benefits, then you start losing out on skills. You're not bettering yourself. You're not learning the importance of showing up to your job on time. You're not getting promotions. You're not getting bonuses because you're an experienced worker. And that really adds up. And we've got to get out of this cycle where we're basically incentivizing people to stay poor by detaching their attachment to the workforce, right? We're discouraging work because Medicaid is what we call a means-tested program, where if you made too much, you lose your benefits. So, you know, that I think the work requirements is key. I think there are other ways to look at it to make sure that we're getting the benefits, we're reviewing our Medicaid rolls, because again, during the Biden era, we had a Medicaid expansion where the federal government paid people a lot of money not to review Medicaid. And once you were on the program, you know, you could not go off even if you're ineligible. So states need to take a look, and this could save really hundreds of billions of dollars, to make sure that people on the Medicaid program actually qualify for the benefits. And that way you're making sure that the healthcare appointments, the healthcare medicines, the expenditures are going to people who are really eligible, instead of people who may have left the state, instead of people who now have a full-time job, instead of people that the state or the insurance companies can't find that aren't fulfilling appointments. So let's make sure our dollars go further by protecting the vulnerable and making sure that we're reviewing the Medicaid rolls to make sure people are eligible. I think those are some key reforms that are there. And then working with providers, those are doctors, you know, making sure that they can patients can get to the doctor's appointments, making sure doctors have the ability to schedule Medicaid appointments, so we're not putting providers on the hook. You know, these are some common sense reforms we've been playing out, because this is a constant problem states have. Medicaid is usually the biggest part of a state's budget, or right behind K through 12. So policymakers got to get this right. You're going to see a lot more fights during budget season about Medicaid every year, as because the program keeps getting bigger and bigger.
Absolutely. Hey, Ray, thanks so much for coming on the program. Let our folks know what your URL is to check out your work.
Yeah, you can take a look at our website, BuckeyeInstitute.org, and Walker, I have public comments right now on Medicaid work requirements in Ohio, how that's helping workers. So I invite everybody to come visit our website and check us out.
All right. Thanks so much, Ray. Appreciate you coming on.
Thank you, Walker.
All right. BuckeyeInstitute.org. That was Ray Hederman with the Buckeye Institute. He's a vice president of policy there. Hey, one quick note. One quick fact that is just mind-boggling when we talk about work requirements, when we talk about able-bodied working-age adults that are on these welfare programs. Listen to this. This is just having to do with the food stamp program. But in 2000, we had roughly 1.7 million able-bodied, listen to the criteria here. In 2000, we had roughly 1.7 million able-bodied adults between the age of 18 and 59 without children under six who do not meet any other exemption criteria. We had about 1.7 million of able-bodied adults ages 18 to 59 on the food stamp program, 1.7 million. Fast forward to 2017, that was 6 million. Fast forward to today, 12 million. 12 million working age, able-bodied adults ages 18 to 59 on the food stamp program. Folks, we've got to get tougher at telling people you have to work. It's biblical. Work with your hands. We'll see you next time.
Preborn celebrates that Roe v. Wade has been overturned. Roe has been responsible for the slaughter of over 63 million babies. Now the decision to abort a child will be left in the hands of the states, and sadly, abortions will continue in the most liberal states. Over the past 16 years, Preborn has positioned their clinics in the top abortion cities where 50% of abortions occur. Preborn's work of saving babies' lives continues at an even greater level as they save babies' lives and defend their centers from the radical hate groups who want to shut them down. Preborn's response is dependent on you, the pro-life community. Be a part of rescuing lives and changing hearts for Christ. $28 sponsors one ultrasound, and $140 will help to rescue five babies' lives. Dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or go to preborn.com. All gifts are tax deductible.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.